Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality, and is about discovering your place in this great universe, from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guests, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life, and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to be talking about addictions, alcohol, drugs, what happens when you're inside of the pool, what happens when you decide to get out of the neighborhood, and you decide to live a life that's different, it feels changed, but truly, is it maybe towards your soul and your spirit, and you decide to just shed all those other labels and those things and habits that you've had in the past? Sounds easy, doesn't it? I know myself, I've shared many times over the decade on this radio show, is about they're not easy to shed, they're not easy to let go. However, it is a process of knowing, learning, and finding yourself, what you're really made from. How do you really tick? And what would you like to be in this world? Today, my guest is Mallory Neuberger. Her book is Sober House, My Story. Thank you so much for joining us, Mallory. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, you're so welcome. Don't you think, Mallory, I think when you write your story, you start out talking about your mother and your process with her. Do you think that I'm in my 60s now, and I think we find that a lot of us over 50 have seemed to be shedding a lot of the old because we've had a lot of those imprints of excessive drinking, smoking, and drugs from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So what I find is that so many have been engaged in that process, and now, as we say, were we trying to be like our parents, be different than our parents, or never again want to do a process like our parents? I think sometimes people say, oh my gosh, I'll never drink, I won't do that, and they turn around and they might have another issue with a different addiction, or they might need to find out something different in their life. Don't you think that all of these types are just things that were out there, and now it's really in our face to make a decision about our own life?
I know for me and my family of origin, my mother's mother was an alcoholic, and my mother then also became an alcoholic, and I grew up with my mother and grandmother drinking heavily together at holidays, and my grandmother's drinking didn't really affect me because she didn't live with us, but my mother's drinking was very bad, and it was hard to live with, and it was shameful for me because my family didn't talk about her alcoholism, and I was afraid to have friends over, and I was afraid to go out with her places because inevitably she was drunk and she was embarrassing me and, you know, just causing a lot of problems. And so from a young age, I said to myself that I would never be like my mother and that I was going to drink because it was something people do in the world I grew up in, but I wasn't going to drink like her. I was going to drink like a lady. And so when I became a drug addict, it was just, it was a nightmare for me because I had hated my mother and I had judged her and thought that she was a weak person who just wouldn't stop drinking. I didn't understand why it kept going year after year after year until it killed her. And then I found myself addicted to cocaine and completely unable to stop using. And the shame and guilt that I had over that was so intense that I was resigned to just dying a quiet death and just, you know, hoping that nobody would discover the fact that I had been using drugs and that that's what had led to me dying.
You know, I think, Mallory, sometimes we had spoken on this program before with several other guests, and we have said that potentially the shame and guilt of the parent is so heavily felt by the children that potentially they end up having that sort of like imprint in their lives. And they keep going out to try to find ways to express themselves in the world and to be different, to be smarter, to be richer, to have more, to do things differently, that sometimes it just feels like it's almost like it's like a broken part of your heart you just can't seem to fix. And you'll try everything, and inevitably you end up back or circling back to the problems of the parent to be able to fill that space.
That's an interesting way to look at it. You know, I think about, you know, probably as many as 80% of people who are drug addicts or alcoholics do find that they have it in their families, you know, that there are other people who have had the disease. So there definitely seems to be a genetic component. And, you know, so it went from my grandmother to my mother, and alcohol was not for me. Like you said, I wasn't going down that road, and I didn't love alcohol. I enjoyed a glass of wine or a cocktail, but I was not drinking to black out and crash a car and create a scene. And, you know, but cocaine was the one drug I dabbled with and loved. So I'm not saying it's the only drug I ever tried, but at 17, when I tried it for the first time, I felt like it was filling sort of that hole that you alluded to, which was, you know, there was just this like big dark hole in my soul that nothing could fill up. And I do believe that that part of that, probably a huge part, was feeling as a child that I didn't have the love that I felt I deserved. I didn't feel, you know, liked and accepted by my family. And so I sort of went the extreme of, you know, I'm going to get your attention by being bad. You know, I had an older brother who was perfect in my eyes, and he did really, really well in school, and he was a great athlete. And being 3 years older than me and constantly telling me how stupid I was and how bad I was at sports, I believed it. And so rather than trying in school or trying to excel in a sport, I went, you know, I sort of went with, I'm going to be the class clown. I'm going to hang out with the cool kids. I just want to be popular. And, you know, I'm never going to be able to fill your shoes, so I'm not going to even try.
Sometimes it seems that we go out with, like, feelers on, you know, in our teens and early 20s, and it's sort of like, ooh, let me stick my finger in this electric socket to see how if it will wake me up, bring me some sort of response back, or feel like it's something that I've known before. It's sort of like we just keep on doing that and doing that. And a lot of times, you know, when you stick your finger into the thing of alcohol or you stick your finger in the thing of drugs, it's sort of like, I have some imprint of that. That feels good. Maybe I'll just dance with it. You know, I also, too, look at social media now, you know, in the last 20 years, jumping ahead many decades, is also, too, I think, really causing a lot of issues, because there was a time there when it said you need to drink red wine because it has so many vitamins in it. It's the best thing, and it'll save your heart. And now we've got all of these people drinking red wine and, you know, women drinking wine and their sippy cups and all this other stuff. And it's kind of gotten to the point where it's so accepted anymore that it's really around all the time. I mean, I live in the city of New Orleans. Donuts are made with alcohol. You know, every meal's got alcohol in it or with it. Lunch is, if you buy your lunch, you get free booze. So it's very much here all the time, and it's also used for celebrations, and it's used for almost anything that you feel like, you know, stick your finger to the wind, ooh, it's time to drink kind of idea. And I think it depends on how you were grown, how you grew up, who was around you, and what some of those patterns were as to what you're going to engage in. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting, all of those things that you just brought up. I remember as a child, smoking cigarettes was really popular among my parents and their
right.
friends. And my parents always had a cigarette going, and nobody talked about cigarettes causing cancer or any other illnesses. And the commercials on TV really glamorized cigarette smoking. And, you know, I started smoking cigarettes. The first time I tried one, I took a cigarette from my parents when I was 9 years old. And I, you know, I started smoking cigarettes when I was about 12 on a regular basis. And then as time went on, you know, we start getting the warnings that cigarette
right.
smoking can cause, you know, health issues. And
mm-hmm.
then they're suddenly banned from television. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, that has not happened with alcohol. And, you know, I feel like as a woman who works in the field of recovery today, alcohol is the drug that is legal all around our country. And it's the most dangerous drug. I mean, it kills more people than any other drug. And we're hearing about opiate-related deaths all the time, but alcohol is always in first place. But as you said, it's something that's, you know, happy hour and brunch
right.
with endless mimosas or Bloody Marys. And, you know, now that I'm sober, it actually makes me mad, because if I'm going to a restaurant for brunch and it costs $20 and it's endless mimosas, I want, you know, endless sparkling water with lime, and they're not giving me that. Like, that's not part of the brunch.
Right, right.
You know, I actually feel, like, discriminated against now that I don't drink, because I feel like I don't spend as much money when I go to restaurants as I used to. So I don't feel as much in favor with the people who own or work at the restaurants as when I was ordering expensive wines. And when I order sparkling water with lemon and lime at the beginning of a meal, the server will come back up to me and say, "And what would you like to drink?"
Right.
And I'll
right.
just look at them and I'll say,
yep.
"Well, this is my drink."
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I get that all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing, you know, the other thing that I'd like to bring up is just the legalization of weed, you know, in
mm-hmm.
certain states. And,
right.
You know, I've been following this for about 7 years, you know, since I got sober. And I think it's really bad to legalize more things that are gateway drugs and things that, you know, alter our consciousness the way that alcohol does. And, you know, people are pointing out now that marijuana is not killing people in huge numbers the way that alcohol and opiates are, but the numbers are starting to go up. And states like Colorado, where weed has become legal, are starting to see much higher ER visitation rates and more deaths related to weed. So the research that I've watched, you know, basically shows that anything, whether it's, you know, your first beer or your first cocktail or smoking a joint for the first time, those, you know, those things do make it more likely that you will try other things or become addicted to one of those drugs.
You know, it's, I don't know how, well, maybe I do know, because it's all about money. It's truly all about money and those that are invested in the products that they serve. So a restaurant is not going to listen to your claims because they're vested in making money. People and government are not going to change the laws because they're vested in the tax money. It's mm-hmm. always that way, and it always has been. And I think that, you know, there was some talk the other day here in Louisiana about tobacco. And they were saying that the states, you know, want to raise. You can't buy tobacco until you're 21. And here in Louisiana, I mean, this is where you grow it. And they're going like, no way, no how, you know, you can get it wherever you want it, whenever you want it. And I think also, too, like the ideas they even tried to say, like they do in California about the sugar tax, or was that in New York? I'm not sure. But, you know, Louisiana produces sugar. So they said, no way, no how. So
right.
I think sometimes the idea of when you are in your addiction to its fullest, you're in with everybody that's vested in it. They want to hang out with you. They want to drink with you. They love to pick up your money off the counter. They turn around and they want to buy you something, and you're drunk, you'll even buy for everybody. So
mm-hmm.
I think that what happens is you get invested in family and friends and associations. And when you turn around and say, I don't want to do this anymore, it's almost like you've almost cracked open the egg and there's no putting it back together, because everything starts to disappear. It starts to go into disarray. It turns into chaos. And I think that's where people start to say, oh, I don't want to do that, because then I won't have my friends or my job or something else. And that's really a lot of times the fear that drives people to maybe not quit, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I went to an outpatient treatment program in New York City where I lived when I got sober, and I went there because I needed to stop doing coke, but I had no intention of giving up alcohol. I never
right.
believed that I had an issue with alcohol, and when I went there, they told me that I couldn't drink for the course of treatment. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, as desperate as I was to get help and to get off of drugs, I told them that I would not stay in their program if I couldn't drink.
Right.
And I truly believed that my husband would divorce me and that I would lose all of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, I did not believe that I could live life without alcohol. I was
right.
51 years old. I had been drinking my entire adult life. My entire social life was built around wine dinners and
right.
wine collectors and eating in nice restaurants with the,
yeah.
you know, the good wines. And, you know, I really thought that my life would be over.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I learned in my first day of treatment by drinking a glass of wine that if I drank wine, it made me want to do coke. So my brain was cross-addicted, which means that in recovery today, if I put anything mood or mind-altering into my body, it will lead me back, right back into addiction. And
right.
usually it's worse than it ever was to begin with. And so I got sober, and I didn't tell anyone other than my husband that I was in treatment and that I was getting sober. And Hurricane Sandy hit New York right at the time that I had started my outpatient program. And so the city was pretty much in blackout and closed down, and my treatment center wasn't open. And I was just sort of floating around New York City, petrified of myself and knowing, you know, that I could not drink. And mm-hmm. we ended up meeting up with some friends for dinner. I was with my son and friends of ours who we all met on the Upper West Side, which had power. There was no power in downtown Manhattan where we lived. And the bartender asked us for a drink order. And I told my girlfriend, one of my best friends, I stopped drinking. And she looked at me like I was crazy.
Right.
And she literally turned her back to me. Mm-hmm. And then she turned her bar stool around again and she said, well, you're not going to be fun anymore. And then she turned away from me again. And I walked up to my husband and I said, I cannot stay here. And I said, I told him what she said. And he told me I was being crazy. And, you know, that was what I had feared so badly. And it happened. And at that point, I was only sober about a week and a half. So, you know, there definitely are friends that I have lost because I stopped drinking. And, you know, today the friends that remain my friends from, you know, from the old days, like the fact that I don't drink because it means there's more wine for them to drink. But, you know, I feel like particularly when we're hanging out with people who drink or use drugs the way that we do, they probably have a problem also. So if we get sober, you know, that's scary for them because it might make them question whether they have a problem too.
Yeah, and I think also too, they end up having all kinds of soul-searching ideas themselves, you know, about what their life is about. And sometimes I've seen this in my own experiences is that they go into a tirade and they start becoming very abusive or very angry or whatever that might be. It's almost like they just feel like whatever's inside of them is boiling up and they're calling it something else. And then they put the blame on the other person, like the other person is doing something wrong to them. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's really important to talk about as we talk about your sober house is because many times people will be able to be sober for a period of time and then they'll go into rehab, they'll go into treatment, they'll go wherever. And then when they come back, it's sort of like, well, that was fun. I just took a vacation to Hawaii. I came back and it's the same old stuff. Do you know what I mean? And nothing has truly changed. And then people say, well, what do you mean? Well, we don't have alcohol in the house. Not, everything's changed. But yet the people themselves have not changed or you have not changed in your response to them, which is even more important. Because what happens is people, you know, can't wait to ship you off to be able to get you fixed so that when you come back, you can be appropriate. I mean, I can't tell you the amount of times I've heard that phrase. We want to ship you off to get fixed so you can come back and you'll be appropriate. And it's just so...
you know, what it is truly ignorance about what addiction is. So, you know, for me, when I learned that addiction was a disease, the guilt and shame were cut in half. Like the first person who said that to me, I was so happy, and it made me realize that my mother had not been a weak person. She had been an alcoholic without a solution. And then I found myself worse than she was because I was addicted to an illegal drug. So I felt way more shameful. I would have been happy to be an alcoholic compared to what I was doing. I mean, I could have gone to jail, you know, for just buying cocaine. And I was a mother and a wife and a businesswoman, and I was taking all of these risks that were just completely out of control. And when I finally asked for help from my husband, he suggested that I go away to treatment. And my initial thought was, I'm not going anywhere because nobody's going to know that I'm a drug addict. But then when he said to me, well, what if we say that you're going away for depression? I thought to myself, if I go away for a month, when I come home, I'm not going to know what to do. That is exactly what you just said. I felt like if I was going to get sober, I needed to get sober right in the middle of where I lived, what I was doing. And I know that many people are not capable of doing that because, you know, I've worked with so many people now in recovery. But what I found was the combination of learning about addiction, which I found when I went to outpatient treatment, and then going to 12-step meetings every day and sitting among other drug addicts and alcoholics who were sober and working a program of recovery every single day, I started to see that there was hope, that people just like me, that every kind of person can get sober and stay sober if they work a 12-step program. And I didn't even know what a 12-step program was before I went to my first meeting. I had gone to Al-Anon meetings for about a year and a half, and I don't remember ever hearing about the 12 steps or about sponsorship. And I thought it was just a fun place where you went to complain about people in your family, which, mm-hmm. you know, was something I loved doing. But right. when I came in for myself and I went into Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing that if I picked up drugs again, I was going to die. And, you know, I felt like it was my chance to watch the people around me and to learn from them. So one of the things that we do at my sober house is it's mandatory for people to be going to 12-step meetings at least 5 times a week. And mm-hmm. they need to get a sponsor. And a sponsor is the person who basically takes you under their wing and shares their experience with you and teaches you how to do the 12 steps of the program. And, you know, what I learned was life-changing. I learned that at the age of 51, I was on my fourth husband, and it was always the husband's fault. It was never my fault. Doing the steps with a sponsor, I realized for the first time that I played a major part in why all of these marriages did not work out. And all of the resentments and all of the hurt feelings and disappointments that I had carried around with me, and which made for very interesting, you know, conversation while drinking and drugging with people, was just a story and nothing more. And that mm-hmm. I could spin the story any way I wanted. And when I stopped feeling sorry for myself, when I stopped expecting things from other people that they were never going to be able to give to me because they were so unrealistic, mm-hmm. I finally started to find serenity and peace. You know, so you talked about insanity at the beginning, and you were talking about doing the same thing over and over again. And, you know, so in the 12-step program, I've heard insanity is repeating the same behavior and expecting a different outcome. So I can look at that two ways. One is, as it relates to my addiction, that every single time I bought cocaine, I told myself that I was only going to do a little tiny bit and then I was going to save the rest for another day. Well, at the end of my using, that was impossible. The amount I bought was the amount that was going to be used until it ran out. There was no way that I was capable of saving it. So mm-hmm. in the same way, when I started to work the program of recovery, I realized that if I think other people can read my mind and know what I want, I'm going to be disappointed all the time. So if I get married for the fourth time and I think my husband should go out and buy me the most beautiful flower arrangement for Valentine's Day and have it sent to my house with a beautifully written card, and that doesn't come, then I'm sad and I feel hurt. Well, my husband has no idea that I want flowers, you know, and my husband, you know, the husband I have today will say to me, if you want something, just tell me what it is. You know, I can't anticipate every need that you have. So I think that, you know, what was imprinted on me as a child was I was never getting what I was searching for. And then I would continue to choose relationships where I felt that every man that I married was going to fill that hole inside of me and know everything that, he needed to do to make me happy. And there is no human power on this planet that could do that. And, you know, today the hole inside of me is full. I mean, it's filled with love. It's filled with joy. It's filled with helping other people without expecting anything back. And that's the beauty of the 12-step program. And, you know, you don't have to be a drug addict or an alcoholic to go to 12-step meetings. They have all kinds. There's over 100.
You know, also too, Mallory, is that the idea that when you are doing drugs, when you're coming out of drugs, when you are engaged with others and helping them, all of that is a total illusion story. And as you said, you know, sometimes when we sit down with people and they're talking and you're thinking you're the life of the party and everything's great, it's sort of like when once you get on the other side and there's no looking back, you almost look back and you say, I can't even sit and have a conversation because all of that conversation was just the strangest kind of illusion talk. It really had no validity in its context. And when you sit there and talk about it, it's, are we talking about someone else today? Are we talking about our complaints today? Do you know what I mean? And when you get full and when you get into the other side, your conversations are very short. You just do things more. You might go out and you might walk or listen to music or whatever. But you find that, you know, your actual let's chit-chat on the telephone is very short in comparison to before, don't you think?
Well, I know that I would spend hours and hours, multiple nights a week, just sitting at bars in my neighborhood with a bunch of people who were drinking and doing drugs like I was.
Right.
When I would come home, I would have like this sort of dark sadness, and I would think to myself, that was just a bunch of BS. Like nothing was discussed that was meaningful, and it would be just the same conversations over and over and over, and I was right in the middle of those. And, you know, it's like we just wanted someone to sit with, more or less, so that we could continue drinking and smoking our cigarettes and doing our drugs. And I have found that, you know, those kinds of people, I really didn't have anything in common with probably, or we were just incapable of forming a true connection. The people that I've met in recovery are some of the coolest people I've ever met. And when I talk to them, we're talking about how we save our lives, how we change our lives, how we can help other people and carry the message to them. We're not talking for the most part about just a bunch of fluff. We're talking about real feelings and real behaviors. And I find that those conversations can be like really long and intense and deep. But, you know, in terms of talking about just having those shorter conversations, it's almost like mindfulness where we can just learn to enjoy where we are. So if I go outside and I live in Florida and I walk along the beach, I can just enjoy the beauty of the world that I live in and be grateful that I'm still here and that I have this incredible ocean and glittering sand under my toes and not need to just be chattering about nothing. But, you know, in my line of work, I will say that I don't have nearly enough opportunities for quiet as a normal person because my phone rings 7 days a week, about 18 hours a day.
You know, I think also, too, the idea is that with addictions and or other, let's say, however we chose to have our upbringing in our life, and we turn around and say we are now going to move away from that illusion that we thought we were going to create. We are now creating our life. as it's supposed to be. In other words, our soulful life, what we're really here for, what really is this all about. It's really as a, I almost see it as just like that's when our life really starts to come forth. And I think so many times people will say, oh, no, that's not what I'm about. That's not who I am. And then when you start to ask them who they are, they're sort of like still in that context of all of those outside things. Those, I'm this, and this, and all those labels they wear like a Girl Scout badge, you know. And when you turn around and you ask really about their core principles, they don't have answers. So in essence, addiction is increasing the path toward self versus taking you away from what you were thought you were. You know what I'm saying? And I think sometimes it's such a great gift, and people don't see that, but in reflection, you do see it as a gift, because how else would you have ever gotten to this place? Don't you think?
Yeah. For me, you know, as a child, I wanted to help people. You know, whenever I would see somebody who, you know, had some sort of a physical defect, you know, or some sort of a disease or something like that, I was fascinated from a very young age and wanted to just help people who were blind or, you know, whatever they were. That was what I felt from a young age was my calling. And I went through my master's and was planning to do my PhD so that my life's work could be helping others. And I ended up leaving grad school for financial reasons and going into the business world. So for 31 years, I worked in the business world, and I wasn't getting the satisfaction that I believed, you know, I should have been doing, which was helping other people. So
right.
I would do volunteer work, you know, just to bring some of that stuff forward. But until I became like a real drug addict and I had to get sober, I didn't get my way back into the world that I believe I was born to be in, which is the world of paying it forward and helping other people. And I was able to open my own business, and, you know, I spent a couple of years researching what would be the best use of the skills that I had, and what could I do with the education that I had and not need to go back to school at that point. And I found that there was a huge void of women's sober houses in Florida where I was moving. And it's just a really cool thing to be able to work with all kinds of women from all different parts of the country and other countries. And, you know, we have people come from near and far, and some of them are 18 years old. And I had one who was 70 years old, and some of them are addiction therapists who have relapsed. And some of them are kids who still haven't finished going to high school. Mm-hmm. So we've had, you know, pretty much a complete gamut of women who just can't stay sober. And a lot of them have gone to treatment over and over and over and found themselves unable to stay sober when they got out. So what we're doing is trying to teach them how to be able to go out in the world and be the best version of themselves.
Right.
And how to have fun being sober, because
yeah,
that's a huge challenge.
Mallory, it was such a pleasure to speak with you today. Can you share with the listeners how to find out more information about your work?
Sure. I have a website for my sober houses, which are called the Frog, F-R-O-G, PAD, P-A-D. And that website is the Frog, PAD, Del Rey, D-E-L-R-A-Y, beach.com. And my book, sober.house.mystory, is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's also on Kirkus, K-I-R-K-U-S. We got a wonderful review. And my author webpage is Mallory Neuberger. That's MallorieNeuberger.com.
Well, Mallory, I think in closing, I think the idea is that you and I would wish to drive home is that there are many things out there, there are aspects of our lives and our soul that we're open to explore. And if you are feeling that you're stuck in a spot, ask for help. If you are looking for something differently to expand your life, look for support. Look for other ways to be able to engage in the world. And don't you think that that's truly, no matter where in you are in the past, no matter how many times you went down the road, it really doesn't matter. You will find, you know, your peace in your heart, right?
I believe that. I believe that anybody can get sober and stay sober if they just take it one day at a time and
right.
do the work that they need and find the meaning and purpose in their life that we all deserve.
Well, Mallory, thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. If you'd like to find out more information about Mallory Neuberger, again, her book is Sober House, My Story. Please do click on the link on the bottom of today's show page and go directly to her website. Alcohol, addiction, and drugs, they feel that they have a very nasty story with them. They have a lot of destruction, a lot of pain, suffering. And it truly is time to say, I know I'm okay. I know I'm more than this. I know I can love myself. I know I can honor myself. And I know we can respect and honor others, help others, help yourself. And there truly is help out there. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. Till tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit DrJeanetteGallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.